My name is Catherine Parnell. Everybody calls me Cat. I'm the senior associate editor with Consequence Magazine, which is a journal dedicated to the culture and consequences of war. Enough about me. You want to hear from these guys. And I know you've read their bios, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a... I'm going to recap for you, and I'll summarize it. On my left, we have John Ray. He has published a novel, Godsend, and we'll be talking about that today. His debut novel, The Right Hand of Sleep, was the recipient of the Whiting Award, and in between, he's published a number of novels, including Low Boy. There's a fantastic video on his website under Miscellaneous. If you're looking for something really funny and educational, please check it out. Next to John in the red is Lisa Locascio. She's the co-publisher of Joyland and the editor of 7x7 LA and the anthology Golden State 2017. Her work has been published in some really great magazines, Believer, Tin House, N Plus One, Book Forum. She teaches at Mendocino College and is the director. Did I pronounce that properly?
You did.
Wow. For a New Englander, that's quite good. She's the director of the Mendocino Coast Writers Conference. Open Me, which we're going to be talking about today, is her first novel. Open Me, let me just show you these books. Open Me is purple. It's great, wonderful color. Godsend, John's book, is this black book, which ought to give you a little bit of clue of what's happening in there. It's very dark. Next up, on my far left, is YZ Chin. She describes herself as a synthesizer. She synthesizes words and culture and poetry and code into beautiful and useful things. When I read that, I thought, I can't wait to read her book. Her book, by day, by the way, she's a software engineer. Her book, Though I Get Home, and I'll describe it here, is a heartfelt and harrowing collection of linked stories of people in Malaysia. I hope you don't have to look up Malaysia on Google. So these are the three books that we're going to be talking about. And let me just give you a quick introduction of how things will run, and this will be brief. As you know, these days, everything political is also extremely personal. It sure is. We live in troubled times, and nowhere is this more evident than in the daily tweet storm. And it's also in our literature. The literature we're reading in the world of fiction, lots of us are forsaking easy reads for short stories and novels that go into moral dilemmas in the political and personal realms. In that sense, I think of fiction as a critical intervention, sort of a save me thing. Save me, help me, get me through this, help me think it through. So for the next hour or so, we're going to go around the world, specifically Afghanistan, Denmark, Malaysia, and the threads that connect the works that we're talking about are the dynamics of personal and political extremism, dissidence, censorship and repression, starvation, refugees, through the lens of culture and gender. So our big question today, and I want you to think this through and please come up with some really good questions, is what does the political story look like when tied to personal experience? What happens when the literature of the domestic experience, define domestic any way you want, and political experience are synthesized? So I've asked each writer to read a little bit from their book so you get a flavor, the flavor and flow of their narrative. By the way, after this panel, they will be signing books downstairs in the Gordon Chapel, and I encourage you to buy their books. But I also ask you a favor. When the panel is over, if you'll let us leave first so that we can get down there and be ready for you so that these authors are there when you want to buy the book. Okay. Let's start with YZ. Let's mix this up. YZ, sure. If you want to read.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kat, for the generous introduction. Very happy to be here. Thank you, Boston Book Festival, for having me. So I actually did not describe myself as a synthesizer. I thought those. I don't know where the bio came from, but now it's a mystery. I love it.
Mysteries are good.
Yeah,
it sounds cool though.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I just didn't want
to
take credit for
synthesizer.
Something I didn't come up with. Okay, so my book, Though I Get Home. If you are going to Google Malaysia, then throw in Leonardo DiCaprio in there. Leonardo DiCaprio in Malaysia. there are some fun results there. I'm going to read the first few pages of my book and then the last couple of paragraphs, just because I think it's exciting that way. Hunger pinned her to the bunk. Starvation impaled her through the stomach, keeping her down on the thin mattress, resisting the momentum of her feebly raised head. Her neck strained to bring her vision to the requisite level, such that she could observe the movement of sun against her prison walls. The sun was her way of telling time and estimating the next delivery of food. Not that it mattered now. It was the third week into her detention without child. She did feel secure, as if nothing would ever happen to her again until death. The days lost their shape, shedding the definition of hours and minutes. Her body, too, lost its shape, pulling downward, lowering her center of gravity, rooting her toward dirt and dust. They said she was staging a hunger strike. Issa, on her part, felt that the refusal of food was really to make life behind bars more interesting. The meals they brought to her cell were markers of time, and she had looked forward to the packets of rice and gravy as daily celebrations. But then she'd started feeling like a Pavlovian dog. The nods of the men who handed her sustenance became sinister, laced with degradation. She resented the regular reminders of her weakness and dependency. After minutes of work, she managed to prop herself up on one elbow. A rolling wave of dizziness lurched her, listing, tipping. She smiled widely. In her teenage years, when she had lived a sheltered life, she had tried many times, each attempt lasting days or weeks or months, to go on a diet. It didn't much matter what kind of diets they were or how much science was behind them. The hope was what she needed. She wished on the other side of each experiment to find a slim, beautiful her standing still with folded hands, waiting. And now, locked away, she would finally obtain the thinnest body of her life. She dreamed, still smiling, of her wafer physique gliding effortlessly among obstacles thrown up by invisible enemies. Anything, anybody erected against her, she slipped past with a slight sideways turn of her frame. Her arms extended ramrod above her head, as if surrendering, but really evading, winning. She came to and was disappointed to find that she was again flat on her back, her previous progress negated. Shadows swam before her eyes. She opened them. Men. Men were leaning over her, explaining something, but not to her. To each other, or maybe to an unseen observer. Rank air filled her nose. Rolling her eyes upward, she caught the glance of one man who started talking faster. Hands pressed down on her shoulders, pinning them. Another hand touched her lips. Issa wondered what clothes she was wearing, whether she wore any. Another pair of hands caught hold of her ankles. Her mind, wandering, entertained the absurd vision of a single many-limbed being. It had paused its speech when it extended hands and fists to restrain her, but now it started up again. Issa thought it might be expecting a response from her, but she could not understand it. When she opened her mouth to tell it so, fingers slipped through and stretched her lips. She gagged and mush rushed in, filling her. Of course she tried to spit. Of course she thrashed, at first. Then the mush began to acquire flavor and become more than texture. It tasted first like somebody else's vomit, and then like her own. And then it became her, and she was being force-fed herself. She reclosed her eyes. Up floated a piece of advice from her dead father, given a lifetime ago. What to do when overpowered by a criminal, such as a robber or a rapist? Do not fight. Survival should be your only focus. Everything other than your continued breathing, be it jewelry, money, body, honor, is expendable. Save your life. Do not fight. Oatmeal. That was what they were forcing into her mouth.
YZ, thank you so much. That's great.
Sorry, just to give a bit of context, that's the main character of the book who has been put in jail for writing insulting poems, insulting to the government. So that's the context. Thank you.
Very important part of the book. Lisa?
You know, I'm not going to say anything about the context here, except for that the narrator is American and in rural northern Denmark. The next night, Søren brought home a movie he thought I would like about a poor young girl growing up in a housing project in England. One morning, the girl goes downstairs and puts a saucepan of water on the stove. She is dancing alone when a man's voice surprises her. A shirtless stranger has entered the room, lithe, muscled, rough. My eyes traced his golden triangle of shoulders, waist, crotch. The Swiss actor from the science fiction movie, The Android. She is in her underwear and a purple t-shirt, and he is in jeans only, which sit low on his hips, revealing the incipient curve of his ass. The ridges of muscle in his torso, his flickering arms as they make breakfast, the camera, her eye. Beside me, Soren fell asleep, slackening, his breath slowing, his soft lips pressing, his elegant hands unclasped, released. At a party, the girl steals a bottle of vodka from a couple engaged in the early stages of intercourse in her kitchen. She drinks herself to sleep on her mother's bed, waking to her mother and her mother's new friend, the lovely man, talking beside her. The mother wants to tell her to leave, but the man shushes her, scoops the girl up in his arms, and carries her to her bedroom. The girl is awake, but the man thinks she is asleep. They pass through the hallway in lush layers of darkness, gray on black. The man's arms around her, the dark passage of the hallway, her secret wakefulness. He lays her in her bed, takes off her sneakers, rolls down her socks, gently, gently. Her body, asleep but not, that reverent state in which the form, independent of the mind, seeks to be perceived as unconscious. If he learns she is awake, the spell will break. He takes off her pants, revealing modest white underwear. He folds the pants, covers her with a blanket, turns off the light, leaves. That's all. He's a good guy, at least for tonight. The girl opens her eyes in the dark. Søren's breath caught in his throat made a kind of sucking sound. Sometimes when I watched movies stoned, I couldn't focus. Sometimes I fell asleep and woke, slept and woke, deeper and deeper, until waking up was like dragging myself out of a pit. This annoyed Søren. Wake up, Scott. We are spending time together. I wanted what I saw when I let my eyes unfocus and the shapes on the screen went blurry. The contours of his body and the beats of the scenes already inside me, ready for replaying. I turned off the movie when Søren was safely asleep. I was tempted to rewatch the scene where the man carries the girl to her bedroom. But instead, I rose from the couch as quietly as possible and went into the bathroom, the only room in the apartment with a lock. Not even a lock, really, just the little latch bolted to the door frame. It would do. I had learned to avoid the mirror when entering the bathroom, to hold my head so I wouldn't see my unholstered breasts loose hanging above my tummy in Søren's shirt. Seeing my body would compromise my ability to dream the man. The fantasy was coming together in dissonant, embarrassing points. I had to not think about it too much.
Thank you, Lisa. John?
I'm going to read from a novel called Godsend. It's about an 18-year-old girl from Northern California who becomes interested in Islam right around sort of year 2000 and ends up going to the tribal regions between Pakistan and Afghanistan with the hope of studying the Quran in a madrasa there, and who disguises herself as a boy to be allowed to study there with her friend. And I'm going to read a section in which, after this girl whose name is Aidan Sawyer has fallen in with a group of militants fighting in Afghanistan. She and her companions first hear of the events of 9/11. At the frontier to Panjshir, a company of Kabuli Taliban met Aidan's company by chance, likewise headed to Kunduz by the northern trail. They were a far larger body of soldiers, self-disciplined and silent, their clothes and guns immaculate and black. They seemed warriors in some different cause entirely. The other men regarded them with awe. The Kabuli captain wore a camel hair greatcoat in spite of the heat and chewed on a blade of grass as he conferred with Ziar, her captain. The two were in conference for nigh on an hour, and it seemed to Aidan, as she watched them, that some momentous event must have occurred, some cataclysm. She decided that Kunduz had been lost, or that the northern line had broken, or that the great emir in Kandahar was dead. At last the two men stood and embraced, and Ziar gave orders for a meal to be prepared. The captain had returned to his men and was directing the assembly of a field radio. The others were unrolling their prayer rugs, but Aidan stayed as she was and observed the man. With his straggling beard and his preposterous coat, he looked less like the bearer of solemn tidings than a beggar costumed in a rich man's clothes. But his men, with their jet-colored vestments and their new and gleaming ordnance, looked like martyrs on their way to paradise. "They aren't praying," someone behind Aidan whispered. "Why aren't they praying?" "They must have prayed before we got here," said another. "Have you been sleepwalking, brother? We got here at the same time." "That captain, he must be a warlord. They aren't Taliban at all." "Of course they're Taliban. Look at their clothes. Look at their weapons." "If those are Taliban," said the first man, "then what in the hell are we?" Everyone laughed but Ziar. He had yet to say a word. "I know what that machine over there is," Abu Suhail said proudly. "It's a kind of radio." "A field transmitter," Ziar said, "for talking to Kabul." "He's using it now," said the second man. "Do you hear him using it?" "I thought music was forbidden," the man who'd made the joke said sullenly. "It's not that kind of radio, you donkey. It's for talking to one person." "That's right," Ziar said. "It's for receiving orders, brothers, and for getting news." Something in his manner hushed the men. The wind carried the sound of the radio to them in soft, unintelligible rushes. Ziar ate his flatbread and sipped at his tea, nodding to himself as if he were alone. When she couldn't stand it any longer, Aidan asked what the captain had told him. "It's America," said Ziar. "America," she said. He looked toward her now. "A strike," he said. "An attack in the capital and in another city." She slumped slightly forward. "What kind of a strike?" The others turned as one to look at her. She ignored them all and waited for Ziar's answer. The radio fell sharply into focus. A young man's voice, speaking Arabic with an unfamiliar accent. When no answer came, Aidan stepped out of the circle and walked through the grass to where the other captain sat hunched over this crackling apparatus like an alchemist transmuting dung into gold. Two boys sprang up to block her approach, their hands already at the knives in their belts, but the captain waved her forward. He'd taken off his coat and rolled up his sleeves, and his fingertips and palms were dark with grease. She waited for him to address her. The young man on the radio was reporting on the weather in Kunduz. "Kichare sahib," Aidan said, finally, in her impatience. The boys shook their heads at her lack of decorum. The captain slowly set his tools aside. The American, he said in English, the American pays us a visit. Yes, sir. He beckoned her closer, flaring his nostrils as though the smell of her were difficult to bear. I would ask you the reason, he said, but on this day, I imagine I can guess. I'd be thankful for whatever you can tell me. He cleared his throat. The city of Manhattan, you know of this city, the great financial district at its center? What happened? She said. There is no financial district any longer. There is no trade tower. There is no stock exchange. These things, said the captain, have passed away. The smallest sigh of disbelief escaped her. The air seemed to thicken. Aidan saw herself in faded video, her image degrading, her outline blurred by violence. In spite of all her subterfuge, America had found her. She closed her eyes and saw a grid of streets subsiding into history. No escape was permitted. She was on the ground, and she was in the plains. She had gone to the opposite end of the earth, to the void zone on the map, and America had found her. It had found her so quickly. She thought of her small, drab life in Santa Rosa, of the mosque in the strip mall where she had once gone, of her childhood friend Decker asleep beside her on her narrow, creaking bed. She opened her eyes. These things have passed away.
Thank you, John. That brings me to my first question, which is all of you detail locations in your novels and your in YZ's case, collection of short stories. How did you choose the dominant setting? And what sources did you rely on to inform your work? Anybody?
I can go first because it's easy for me. I was born and raised in Malaysia. I left when I was 19 years old, so you know, by some definitions, an adult. And the reason I chose to write about Malaysia is because I now condense the story, but I had left Malaysia already trying to be a writer. I'd always wanted to be a writer. And I didn't realize until I enrolled in an undergraduate writing program when my professor sort of was discussing my senior thesis with me. And it was a thesis that had a lot of romantic relationships in it. And he was asking me, not in a weird way, in a very helpful way, why is there no sex? I know it comes across abrupt and kind of absurd, but it was actually a really insightful question. It led me down this path of really interrogating my own writing, and I realized that because I'd grown up under state censorship, a lot of things are banned or cut or modified. There were a lot of things I had unconsciously not allowed myself to address in my work, so I was very upset with myself, obviously. I couldn't really think of myself as a writer at that point. So the book is really started as a way for me to confront and address the self-censorship that was a result of state censorship. And so the setting is important because that's where it all began for me.
For me, I was able to visit Denmark for several prolonged month-long trips between 2011 and 2015. And I became very interested in the way that, Scandinavian whiteness as represented in the United States in the last 10, 20 years is, I think, really a comforting fantasy for many Americans to retreat into, is a place where a social welfare state has been established and functions well, and whiteness is something other than like the nasty aftermath of centuries of genocidal rule over other people. And so I was living in Los Angeles. I saw the trend for hygge everywhere, and I was also going to Denmark a lot. Denmark is an interesting place for many reasons, some of which are the fact that it is really the gateway between Western Europe and Scandinavia, and so it is seen as both provincial and cosmopolitan in relation to its northerly neighbors, Sweden and Norway. And it's a place where the Enlightenment was actually held off for about 200 years. So Danish literature and art has had these fits and starts. It's also a place that was then and is now a locus of what we now, you know, recognize as one of the greatest human migrations in history. And as someone who grew up in America in the suburbs of Chicago, I was really curious to see the way that people in this very, you know, again, by my American standards, well-functioning small nation imagined their relationship to immigrants, refugees, and asylees in their midst. They do not have a legal standard of birthright citizenship, and while they have been extremely open-doored to displaced people, they've also done so with that kind of characteristic European expectation that once things calm down at home, people will go back to where they came from. The imagined Danish citizen is white, and while performatively atheist, culturally Lutheran, and drinks alcohol and eats pork meatballs, and it's very difficult to assimilate into the culture that expects the total repudiation of the public performance of your difference. So in the midst of all of this, I was meeting all these lovely, well-intentioned Danish people who worship the history of the American Civil Rights Movement, condemn American racism, and do mawkish, weird things like having Danish kindergartners sing African-American spirituals as a statement of solidarity. And these people would swear up and down that, you know, there was no racism in Denmark, but also just about have a conniption at the sight of a hijab. And that was all very, very, very interesting to me. So that's why I wrote about Denmark.
Well, in my case, my novel never would have come about if I hadn't first gone to Afghanistan, the place where most of the novel is set. I was in Afghanistan as a journalist working on an article for Esquire magazine about 5 years ago. And part of the article I was there to write had to do with a young American named John Walker Lind, who was sort of infamous for a while and is still known by to some people as the quote-unquote American Taliban. And I was looking for people who had known him, who had personally known him, or at least who had known of him or had seen him in action in various... he's a young American who's still in prison now in the Midwest. And so I was being taken around Afghanistan. This was right after Obama pulled the troops out. It was a few weeks afterwards. So there was still a grace period in which it was believed that things would be relatively safe and stable. I was being taken around the country by a wonderful man named Nuruddin, who was keeping me alive, essentially, and translating for me. Watching a lot of Rihanna concert videos in on a TV screen in his car as he was driving 100 miles an hour. A wonderful person, though. So he was helping me talk to people because I don't speak any of the four main languages that are spoken in Afghanistan. And we found an old man in a small town about an hour north of Kabul who was very talkative, very friendly. I asked him, "Did you know the American boy who had fought with the army of the Taliban?" And he said, "Oh, yes, well, I didn't know him personally, but I know all about the American boy. And I also know about the American girl." And we sort of all, you know, we stopped, and I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, oh, the American Girl, blah, blah. And he told a brief but very interesting story in which he claimed that an American teenager who may have in fact been a Dutch teenager, who may in fact have been an Irish teenager, had also fought, or in some capacity served in the actual army of the Taliban during the period of time when they were fighting the quote-unquote Northern Alliance. And that was, of course, unbelievable to me. And my priorities shifted immediately for the remaining weeks that I was in Afghanistan to try and find out more about this girl. And once or twice we did come across people who had at least heard this sort of rumor. But we were never able to make any further progress than that. And right around that time, when I was really in a state of despair because I was going to have to leave Afghanistan very shortly, and I felt this was an incredible story that I felt like a complete failure as a journalist. And then suddenly I remembered that I'm not a journalist. Thank God, I write novels mostly. And it was sort of, I probably should have realized that about 3 weeks earlier. But then I realized that these enormous blank spaces in the story that we were able to cobble together, which we were also never able to confirm, were in fact the places where the novel could begin and really, really come to life. You know, I think when you're writing fiction that has to do with historical events or any sort of real world events, quote unquote, it's very important to know as much about your subject as possible, but it's good to have blank spaces or places where various witnesses contradict one another, because that's where fiction can, that's where your imagination can kick in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Those are fascinating stories, especially the one about the American woman in Afghanistan.
Which may be apocryphal. There may not have been
so many things are apocryphal these days, yes.
That's true.
I know. We live in apocryphal times, or maybe it's Armageddon, I'm not sure. This sort of takes me to my next question, which I prepped these guys on because I wanted a really definitive answer, or at least I wanted them to think about it ahead of time, and I'm going to read it to you. It's a question that I like to ask just about every writer I meet. Author of Abandon Me, Melissa Phoebos, in a Poets and Writers article wrote, "For many years I kept a quote from Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet tacked over my desk. The work of the eyes is done. Go now and do the heart work on the images imprisoned within you." My question for these three people is, how did you find your way into characters with images imprisoned within them, or characters responding to images around them and the events they encountered? Let's start with Lisa.
Well, I'm a great believer in the deceptive quality of quotidian reality, in that I think we're led culturally and individually to diminish and disregard our small insights and triggers and memories and moments of recognition, and also just the surpassing strangeness of life. And I think it's a important artistic and really revolutionary act to reclaim the interiority that encapsulates us and surrounds and produces our identity. So the earliest inspiration that I had for this book was that I really wanted to write a novel in which a woman's interiority was the plot, in which the action, such that it was, came from inside the self as much as it came from outside. And what was interesting about that was that it made the book more and more bodily, because I realized part of what I felt was missing from literature was a literature of feminine scatology. I really did not see a literature that gave voice to and celebrated and dissected menstrual blood, vaginal secretions, and really the gooiness of sex, which is, in my opinion, one of the only physical manifestations of the highest human experience, which is intimacy. So by looking at the interior and the preoccupations of one person and the way that the preoccupations of the people around her, who she hopes to know well but also is fundamentally separated from, as we all are, I sought to really dignify the lives that I wanted to write about, which is why I want to write at all.
So that was a really interesting quote to me when I read it. So it says, it starts with, the work of the eyes is done, right? And so what is state censorship? State censorship is taking away, you know, what you see or editing your reality in a way. And how state censorship manifests, or my experience of it was I didn't know it was happening, right? Like, how can you know that something is missing if you didn't know it existed in the first place? And so for me, movies and songs, it was really natural for things to not make sense. So, like, you know, one scene there would be two people almost kissing, then the next scene it's like someone waiting for a bus. And stuff has been disappeared between these two scenes, but I grew up accepting that things can just happen with zero connection. And I realized really, really much later that that probably did things to my brain. And I wondered if it also did things to other people, if it in any way made unacceptable things more acceptable because you anticipate things not making sense, not connecting. And for example, one of our country's political, Malaysia's political opponents was put in jail on false charges of sodomy, which sounds utterly ridiculous. In what part did state censorship sort of help people accept that, yeah, this totally can happen? I don't know. I'm just a writer. But that was my work that I felt I owed it to myself. I wanted to ever call myself a writer to interrogate the effects of self-censorship, which is kind of within my control. And in doing that work, I found these images imprisoned within me, as the quote so eloquently puts it. It was obviously a lot of sex. We don't talk about sex. And a lot of bad treatment of LGBTQ people. A lot of repression, and the more I dug in myself, the more I sort of saw it wasn't just an issue with me. For example, my grandparents worked for the British colonial officers, but I imagined that they must have at some point picked up a few words of English, like, you know, please eat or whatever. But I never heard them speak English, never. And I never heard them talk about their jobs. So it was just, I felt even within my own family, there was a lot of self-imposed, like, oh, we don't talk about these things. And so there was like a flood, really, of images that I felt needed to be released. And I tried to put some of them into the book and in other forms of writing. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. And the man who was brought up on charges of sodomy, something happened with him today, right? The election, he's the new...
So the same ruling party since independence of Malaysia was defeated finally this year. Shockingly, everyone was surprised, me included. I voted and I was surprised. And so it's a plot twist worthy of a whole book. It's like a soap opera almost. The original prime minister who put this opposing politician in jail on these false charges, he's like 90-something now. He didn't like his successors of his original party, so he switched sides to the opponent's party, won the election when he's 90-something, and then released this man whom he put in jail in the first place. Mind-blowing. But then, there are other funny things happening in other countries. So. I'm sorry, I had to.
Oh, don't hold back.
Lobo.
I love what you said. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I love what you said, though, about the idea of a sensibility or a worldview shaped by jump cuts.
Yeah.
You know, a jump cut is sort of an essential, fundamental sort of a way of editing an entire culture. That's kind of a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
Could I ask you to repeat the quote from Rilke again? Because
sure,
at this
sure.
point,
The work of the eyes is done. Go now and do the heart work on the images imprisoned within you.
So, what I think is interesting about it is that my understanding of what Rilke is saying is you as the writer, you have now done your observing. You've gathered your information. Maybe you found a story that you would like to tell. But that is really only a kind of initial phase and not essentially the fundamental phase of putting something down in writing, because you have to, in my experience, especially, probably not actually especially, but certainly in this case where I was writing about people whose experiences were very different from my own. Obviously, the protagonist of my novel, who goes to Yemen and then Pakistan and then Afghanistan as an 18-year-old girl with a tremendous amount of courage and but also a deep religious belief, is very different from me. And even more different in their life experiences are the characters she meets in Pakistan, in the tribal regions, and in Afghanistan. I mean, you can spend time in a place, but it's, you know, you should never fool yourself into thinking that you have any particular insight into the way such people might live. But at the same time, to make any character believable and fleshed out and really simply interesting, you have to look inside yourself and begin sort of with a person who has a lot more in common with you than they have, whose common ground with you is more important than the differences they may have. And then you kind of work your way out, in my experience, until you reach, you sort of, as you work, as you revise, as you write, you move farther and farther away from your own life experience. But I think that it's important to start by assuming that this is someone who has more in common with you than, you know, than they may have in common with you.
Yeah, no, that's such an interesting. I agree with you. It's very interesting in light of Godsend, because the main character is a young girl who assumes the identity of a young man, and so, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking, okay, the commonality is what, high school?
Being pissed off at your parents.
Being pissed off at your parents.
I remember what that feels like.
The confusion of youth.
But I learned this from a wonderful writer who passed away recently named Shirley Hazard. I don't know if anyone here has read anything by Shirley Hazard. She really was an extraordinary writer, and I was fortunate to be able to meet her and to learn from her. And she really introduced that idea to me, which begin with yourself and move outward in a sort of slow spiral, which at first seemed very strange to me. Not the same thing as find your voice, which I think is a bunch of malarkey.
I agree. All right, that's really good. It's very interesting, just thinking about this, the idea of the jump cuts, you know, navigating the terrain of the intimate personal body. And what it leads me as a moderator, and maybe some of you, to be thinking about is the idea of what's really personal. You know, John has referenced, you know, youth. We're talking about sex. We're talking about jump cuts. We all understand that jump cut thing, because sometimes our mind works that way. We were all young at one point. So here's my next question is, what role does the idea of starvation and sexuality play in your work? Because clearly the characters in these two novels and this collection of linked stories, they're starved, physically starved in YZ's case. And then in Lisa and John's case, there's also a sexual starvation in John's case, maybe a little sexual starvation, but mostly a spiritual starvation. So tell me more about this idea, how you worked out this idea of being wanted or not wanted and worked it into characterization in the plot.
Well, I'll take that one. I did not see in literature a depiction of a female body longing for sexual intimacy and being denied it. It is very interesting to me that just this year we've seen sort of an explosion of, you know, the so-called incel movement as a violent force in our culture. The word incel has its roots actually in the work of an activist, a queer woman, who was trying to create a community of people who felt distanced from sexual intimacy and, you know, were losing hope that they would ever get to experience it. And the fact that it's been co-opted as a tool of a misogynistic and authoritarian worldview held by a handful of angry people is really, I think, a failure of discourse in addition to all the other horrible things associated with that so-called movement. As a desiring body, you become very conscious of the fact that there are requirements for your desire, for who gets to feel desire and whose desire will be met. And I found it interesting that in discussions of the book, there has been relatively little focus on that element. Every writer, of course, has a dream idea of how their book will be received, and I'm happy that anybody thinks about or looks at my book for half a second, so this isn't sour grapes. But I really wanted to write a book that created a space for that kind of pain, because women, femme people, are really told that that's not a pain that they get to feel. You see that some of that in the incel dialectic, but I also just see it in literary fiction. And so I wanted to write against that, and I wanted to give voice to a full-throated longing for something that I think is one of the deepening experiences of human life.
Lisa, that's great. It's time for us to take some, see if there are any questions. Does anyone have a question? I see no hands up. Oh, way in the back. And then we'll come back to John and YZ.
It's like a game show. I always love it when you're on the microphone.
Hi, thank you all for sharing your really insightful and provocative comments. I was interested in the name of the session and listening to you talk is the personal is political, right, which is of course a women's movement phrase, which is used to say, well, that our personal experience are actually when we see our personal experiences made public, realize it's actually part of a political project, part of a system of oppression that we can act on. And what I've heard a lot in your thoughts is really how the political is personal, about how to humanize and think about the ways that bodies and like our actual psyches and emotions and selves are impacted and shaped by the political waters in which we swim. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the dialogue between those two projects, between making politics personal in a novel, for example, and then what it does to readers who are reading this and understanding these personal stories as part of a broader set of political forces. Does that make sense?
That's a good question. I think you're getting at the idea of audience, maybe. Guys, what do you think?
Well, I think one way of understanding politics, of course, is as a kind of mass agglomeration of, in the case of the United States, for example, a few hundred million personal ways of viewing and understanding the world and interpreting sort of one's environment as something that acts upon oneself and can be acted on perhaps to a limited degree. So I don't know. I mean, it's very hard to write a novel of any kind, I think, without focusing in on perhaps one or two or a handful of individuals. You know, maybe John Dos Passos tried to write novels in which sort of the entire American population was his protagonist, but it's awfully hard to do that because it just becomes an abstraction, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I had a little bit of trouble following the question, but if I understood correctly, you're asking how in our writings do we transform the personal into political, maybe?
I see.
Yeah, so my book is a series of connected short stories. So in that sense, it's, I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, I did set out to write about a series of different people who are variously affected by state policies. So they are citizens or of the same country or the previous incarnation of the country, Malaya, which is the colonial version of the country. And so in there are some people who there are people on different sides of this political spectrum. In one story, there is a man who joins a religious volunteer task force to go on literal morality raids, where he and his buddies would go catch people having premarital sex, or, you know, trans people just trying to form a community. He goes and busts them up. And that's a very different story than it's a, that's a very different political impact on his personal life, right, than the woman who is put in jail for writing offensive poems. So my, I think this is a, this is kind of a different setup though. I agree with what Lisa and John are saying. A lot of what is compelling for me in novels is the representing the interiority, the sort of start with myself, sort of the personal, and figure out how external forces, including political forces, apply pressure on the trajectory of my characters' lives. That makes sense.
I mean, just to build off what my two esteemed colleagues here have said, I think the project of portraying interiority is innately political because there are so many forces allied to deny our interiority and to deny our realization and our apprehension of reality. And I mean, my book, you know, does some somewhat conventional things in that, you know, there's a character who is a refugee who has a story to tell, which is distinct from, and I think of some interest, particularly, I mean, to any reader, I hope, but also to Americans who maybe don't know about the history of, you know, people displaced by the Balkan War who had experiences in camps for resettlement in Scandinavia. But I have to say, I feel most political about my book when I read my Goodreads reviews, where prudish, prim, and offended reader after reader performs the patriarchy's work for itself and calls my narrator stupid, dirty, whorish, sexually ravenous. They say that if she was their daughter, they would lock her in their basement. They wonder where her father is. And 18-year-old explorers who are men and go to foreign countries and have strange sexual experiences are known as heroes, but I'm learning what the word for that for a female protagonist is. And so it is the act of writing and giving voice to an experience which, I mean, compared to my next book, like this one was very like sweet Candyland type stuff.
Can't wait.
I am confirmed in that. But I'm also really glad all those people read my book, and I hope it haunts them.
Yeah, Goodreads and Amazon and various forms like that. It definitely is a place where the political gets very personal. Very.
I also just wanted to add on one quick thing, which is I feel like a lot of situations, you do start with personal, and it's political against your force, like, you know, state oppression against you because of your sexual orientation. That is fundamentally a very personal thing, and it's like you're trying to make it political. It's being imposed on you, right?
Yeah.
Well, John, did you get a chance? You did answer that question. So
I think so.
All right, so that brings me to something else that I bet we're all thinking about, and I sort of alluded to that earlier, is who are you writing for? Who's your audience? Because, and you know, Lisa's book is very specific, as she's noted. YZ is writing about oppression in Malaysia, and my guess is that a lot of people don't even know where Malaysia is, or that there is a Malaysia. And John is writing a book about something that happened in the recent past, but he's transformed it. And I'm not sure, I don't know. I mean, how willing are people to start reading things about people who are involved in and around events circling 9/11? So who's the audience?
These people here.
Not fair. Who's the audience?
All right, I'll just start off by saying that if you don't know where Malaysia is, zoom in on Asia. It's the part that sticks out like a penis. And then Singapore.
We love YC.
Oh, sorry. Just trying to be educational.
But seriously, what?
What
who,
kind of
who
penises
doesn't...
have you seen?
Who doesn't know where Malaysia is? I'm sorry. Like, there's an expectation in public discourse, and I'm sure that you encounter this quite a lot. I mean, people don't know where Denmark is either. They talk about the Dutch people in my book.
Ooh.
But I mean, you know that. Anyway, I mean, there's an edification in each of these books, but there's.
Yeah,
I think we all have goals beyond the geography.
Right, yeah. I actually really, really like that because what you just said, because, yeah, I did think about audience much later. You know, obviously when I started the book, it was all me, like, oh my gosh. There's self-censorship in me, horrible, get rid of it. So I didn't really think about an external audience till much later, but, you know, I didn't want to make it like a tour guide fiction thing. I didn't want to say in my book, here is Malaysia, here's, you know, what's typical of things in here, blah, blah, blah. I just wanted to jump right in and talk about, just go to what is the most deeply personal, most important things to the characters in the book. So I think the audience is really just anyone interested in exploring what state policies can do to people on an individual level. That's what I was hoping people would do. And I was hoping the audience will also take away that there are a lot of unknown dimensions to other people that you meet. And these dimensions might be hidden from themselves even, which is how I felt about my grandparents much later on. And so that's what I was hoping the audience would take away. Yeah.
Oh, I just, to give a less flippant answer to your question, I'm sorry, I feel bad now.
Okay.
I'm always trying to crack regrettable jokes. But I just think that, I don't know how it was for you guys, but when you're first trying to write a book, I think it can be very dangerous to think too much about who the audience may be because it can be very intimidating or even so discouraging that you might just abandon ship, you know. I mean, I had the feeling that maybe some people would not be so into the subject matter. Strangely enough, I thought in the United States it might run into difficulty because it does treat someone who has a certain amount of sympathy for militant Islam with sympathy and empathy to a certain degree. But in fact, there were repercussions I had not anticipated. My longtime French publisher dropped me as a result of this book. They said, this is not a topic that we want to deal with in France. Not right now. And I was incredibly surprised because I really thought about, I expected the main sort of knee-jerk backlash to be here at home. But I think if one were to think about, or you guys also, if you think too much about, you know, if you had thought, like, you know, about the potential reaction to what you were doing, it might have been completely debilitating for you as a writer.
I read literature to feel confirmed in my humanity and to experience things I have not, and to be deepened in that human experience. And so I presume, sometimes naively, that that's who my audience is. It's just people.
Those are all really good responses, and I'm wondering, are there any more questions out there? We can't take them right now, but if there are questions, here's the deal. We're out of time.
I'll be back in 2023.
2023. But if you have questions, please come to the signing. If you buy a copy of any of the books, then you can talk to these guys and ask your questions. And I know how hard it can be to ask a question in a big setting like this. I want to thank all of you for coming. If you'll let us please leave first and then join us down in the Gordon Chapel for the signing. Thanks so much.
Thank you.